Roger Cressy had been preparing a PowerPoint briefing for Bush's arrival in Omaha, and Kurtz had done a timeline on what had happened, when, and what we had done. The deck looked good, simple, straightforward. I asked Kurtz to walk it over to the Presidential Emergency Operations Center. Then, remembering the difficulty I had in getting in, I asked my Secret Service liaison officer, Agent Pete McCauley, to escort and vouch for Kurtz. Kurtz and McCauley walked incredulously through the empty White House, past the abandoned interior guard posts. Pete gave the documents to an agent he knew at the vault door in the East Wing for handoff to the Vice President. Together they climbed back up into the open air of the colonnade along the Rose Garden. Halfway to the West Wing, they heard a sudden crashing roar and looked up to see two F-15 Eagles screech across the south lawn at 300 feet, shaking the 200-year-old executive mansion. McCauley pressed his back against the wall. "Holy Mary, Mother of God!" Kurtz, a Holy Cross graduate, completed the prayer. "Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus." The combat air patrol had arrived. The White House was a war zone. Back in the Situation Room, I was looking for Brezhnahan. "POTUS is inbound off it. I need video connectivity to STRATCOM, and I need them to have this PowerPoint." Gary indicated that wouldn't be a problem, but he would need to disconnect the Coast Guard. Just before 3 p.m., we saw Bush stride into the underground bunker at Strategic Command, off at Air Force Base, Nebraska. Everyone stepped out of the West Wing Video Conferencing Center, except Frank Miller and me. The last item on the agenda was supposed to be where the president should be. Instead, we began there. "I'm coming back to the White House as soon as the plane is fueled," the president said. "No discussion. Item 2, briefing by Dick Clark." I walked through what happened from 0850 to 1006. 4 aircraft impacting the earth. Next, the response actions. The nationwide grounding of aircraft. The borders closed. The ports sealed. The forces on DEFCON 3. The government moving to caves. FEMA mortuary units en route to Manhattan. Next was issues for the next 24 to 48 hours. Given that the president had decided to return to the White House, I suggested that a constitutional successor be deployed with a support team outside the city. Commerce Secretary Don Evans was found and moved to a secret location outside the city. We would need another public statement by the president from the Oval Office after his return. Also to be decided was the continued grounding of the air transportation system. Military deployments to guard critical infrastructure here and abroad, and the schedule for reopening the markets. We needed to order the federal workforce to stay home. Basically, we needed the country to go on hold for a day or two until we learned whether there were more attacks coming, until we organized improved security, until we began to pick up the pieces. CIA Director George Tenet was up next. He left no doubt that al-Qaeda had committed these atrocities. He had already been on the telephone to key counterparts around the world, lining up the forces for the counterstrike. Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld briefed on the status of forces. The Atlantic Fleet had departed Norfolk and was steaming with aircraft carriers and cruisers toward New York. He omitted the fact that no one had ordered the Atlantic commander to do that. At times like these, initiative was a good thing. About 120 fighters were finally circling America's metropolitan areas. Forces worldwide were on battle status. FEMA talked of urban search and rescue teams driving up the turnpike to Manhattan. A blood drive was underway. Emergencies were in effect in New York State, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. Then the president was up, out, and in the air, escorted by F-15s and racing for Andrews Air Force Base. His was the only passenger aircraft in the air over America. The skies were clear. Somehow, FAA had landed over 4,000 aircraft, diverting flights from Europe to tiny Canadian fields with few, if any, hotels. Canadian citizens were opening their homes to strangers who were slowly piecing together what had happened to them, what had happened to America.